I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. The Oscars are back, baby, edition. It's Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. On today's show, the 96th Academy Awards go to Oppenheimer. It's true, all of them, they went to Oppenheimer. Not quite, but still, we discuss a almost clean sweep by Christopher Nolan's movie, plus many other fun sundries. These we will discuss with Mark Harris, very good friend of the program and a wonderful film historian and author. And then Shogun has been rebooted and thoroughly done over. This version is striving to be less quote-unquote whitewashed. It's a version of the James Clavell potboiler is now on Hulu. And finally, what happens when a socialist journalist gets sent to cover what has become the very poshest upper 1% of sports? That's Formula One auto racing. We discuss a journalistic debacle in the making. Joining me is Julia Turner of the Annenberg School of Journalism at USC. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate. Hey.
Hey, Steve.
All right, well, Hollywood is in crisis mode these days. Arguably, it's perpetually in that state. But, you know, is it even properly called Hollywood anymore with production dispersed everywhere? What's the fate of theatrical release? Will the streaming bubble burst? On and on and on. Added to which, of course, there is the Oscars, a ritual of self-congratulation that has slid in the ratings recently and is caught between rewarding meritorious work nobody saw or blockbusters everyone saw but generally lack merit, arguably. Still, here we are. The 96th award show was glitzy and, dare I say it, kind of fun, meaningful. Here to help us puzzle through it is Mark Harris, esteemed friend of this show, author of three really great books about film history. Pictures from a Revolution is just such an amazing book, story of Hollywood in the late 60s, and his definitive biography of Mike Nichols. Mark, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here with you guys. And of course, I'd like to thank my publicist and my stylist. Oh, they're playing the music. I should stop.
No, don't stop. Can't stop. Never stop. But talk through it a little bit. I mean, there's a lot to focus on. Killers of the Flower Moon and by and large Barbie shut out Oppenheimer, effectively a near sweep. What caught your eye this time?
Well, first of all, I did think it was a pretty good show. And they had a lot going for them in terms of, you know, Oppenheimer and Barbie being two really critically acclaimed and hugely popular movies. There wasn't that weird gap between great movies that nobody saw and, you know, a token blockbuster that people didn't really like that much. They had a lot to celebrate. And you know, the Oscars are always an occasion on which Hollywood tries to put its best face forward and maybe paper over some of the more difficult stuff. But I thought it was interesting and notable this year that the show started with like the most oratorically and visually stentorian pro-union affirmation that I've ever seen on the Oscars. I mean, there's a lot wrong in Hollywood right now. There's a lot of scary things in Hollywood right now. But one thing that they did not sweep under the rug was what a horror last year was in terms of the industry stopping dead for 6 months. I thought it was really an unexpected and moving thing to bring the whole union crew out on stage right at the beginning of the show. I loved that.
And it was not just a union affirmation. It was practically a strike authorization. I mean, it was both a thank you to the behind-the-scenes workers and Teamsters who stood with the striking actors and writers this year, but also a reference to the forthcoming negotiations in 2024, right, and essentially like a gigantic public pledge that everybody there in sequins would be, you know, back at the barricades if necessary, which was a lot more political than either the Oscars host or Jimmy Kimmel sometimes is. So I agree, that struck a very notable tone.
Yeah, it was, to me, a pretty political show all the way through, and not political in the way that award shows sometimes are, where six people are making the same point in six speeches. But, you know, besides that union moment, you had Syslav Chernov's speech when he won for the Ukraine documentary, 20 Days in Mariupol. We had, of course, Jonathan Glazer's still very controversial speech when he won for the Zone of Interest. And then some more sort of small bore stuff. The winner for the documentary short, The Last Repair Shop, advocating for underfunded Los Angeles public schools. Even some industry politics got in there. Besides the strike, you had Cord Jefferson, who won Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction, getting up and saying, I think really strikingly, hey, Hollywood, instead of making one $200 million movie, make 20 $10 million movies. And that really stunned me, first of all, because he's like the only creative in the history of the Oscars who can actually do math on the spot like that. And and second, because, you know, he had a little bit of a captive audience in a way of some of the people who make those decisions. And you heard the sort of ringing affirmation of what he said from the audience. And it kind of indicated to me that there was a little sort of blockbuster slash franchise fatigue in the house, even among people who are responsible for making those movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mark, that it really impressed me in this ceremony that when politics entered the ceremony, it was through voices that should have been talking about politics because of the content, either the content of their projects or their status within the industry, and that it didn't have that very easily mockable and criticizable quality of some, you know, a glamorous starlet who won for a movie that has absolutely nothing to do with the issue she's talking about, getting up and sort of, you know, shaking her fist about some sort of global injustice. So there was, and of course, also the union moment that kicked off the show. So it was nice to see an Oscars where the politics and the glamour weren't completely divergent and coming together at bizarre and inappropriate moments.
Right. And even especially with the Israel-Gaza moment, you know, the show started 5 minutes late this year, partly because protests outside of the theater delayed the arrival of a number of stars. They literally could not get stars into their seats fast enough for Jimmy Kimmel to start at 7 Eastern. So there was a big question, is anybody going to talk about this? Is anybody going to acknowledge the world situation? And of course, you couldn't have picked a more appropriate person than the Jewish director of the Oscar-winning Best International Feature, The Zone of Interest, which is about the Holocaust, to bring it up. There's no one out of whose mouth this would have been more natural and less of a stretch. And that's what happened.
I totally concur with everything said. I thought, weirdly, it was an elegantly presented program that made me feel good about reverting to an anachronistic viewing habit, like literally a bowl of popcorn and my nuclear family seated on a sofa, sitting still for 3 hours. And there's always that question of like, how do you, it is the question of stardom, right? Especially in the digital age, which is how do you balance awe at how much more beautiful, witty, and talented these people are with the sensation that you're kind of their buddies. And for me, the measure of the ceremony is, do I feel better or worse about Hollywood and better and worse about myself by the end of it? And I was shocked to discover how much I enjoyed those 3 hours. Let me bring the sort of brow down just a little bit and say, Mark, what surprised you about who won and who didn't? Or is it just silly to even bother parsing through it because it's so arbitrary?
You know, this wasn't a ceremony with a lot of surprises, but I think Emma Stone winning Best Actress over Lily Gladstone was probably the closest thing to an upset, and that was really considered a very close race all the way going through. And other than that, it was the favorites, but I do think it's striking. You know, the Academy has changed its membership a lot in the last 10 or 12 years. They have added many more women, they've added many more people of color, and sort of more quietly, they have added many more non-American voters. And I think you really saw that this year. It's notable to me that combined The Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall won more Academy Awards than Barbie and Killers of the Flower Moon combined. That is something that would not have happened at the Oscars 10 or 15 years ago. It's a truly more international selection. And you see that not just in the wins for those two movies, but in the wonderful win of Godzilla Minus One for Best Visual Effects, of The Boy and the Heron for Best Animated Feature, of The Zone of Interest winning Sound, which was a really striking choice. This is an Academy that is does not feel bound to reward only big American studio movies, although, of course, a big American studio movie swept this year.
Mark, I just have to jump in and say that there's a, that the Godzilla win really was the Rocky Balboa moment that the, you know, that the director in his speech cited. And to me, the saddest, one of the saddest playoffs in a night of many people being played off frustratingly early, as always happens, is that, you know, the speech, the prepared speech that the Godzilla director and visual effects director was reading, Takashi Yamazaki, was cut off even as he sort of struggled to pronounce the English that he had so painstakingly written for this utter underdog win. Anyway, that was one of the high points of the night for me because I love that movie.
I gotta say, the Oscars are back, baby. And not only are they back, movies are back. Like, I've been the person on this show haranguing Dana for 5 years about how movies are jazz and nobody cares anymore and my kids don't watch movies. And
love when one of my colleagues tells me every week that my job is meaningless, Julia. It's been real.
While taking out the major American art form with the backswing, I love like getting obliterated.
Well, I gotta be candid and cop to it. This was like so much fun. What a fun night on the couch. What a great year of movies. And they're obviously related, right? Like when there is a triumphant efflorescence of interestingness in cinema, the Oscars get interesting. So my comment here is both, I was wrong, movies are back, baby, the Oscars are back, Jimmy Kimmel for permanent president. But I guess also affirm some of my earlier fears too. And Mark, you obviously wrote an entire book about a crop of Best Picture winners 1 year. Like, this was a year when there were a ton of interesting movies at a ton of different budget levels that were not franchises. Like, it was just a year of creativity and invention. And I don't know quite what to attribute that to, that so many interesting things got made, that it was like, is that sort of an after effect somehow of the pandemic time? Or anyway, but it was just such a bumper crop at all of these different levels. And then the other thing that struck me was that the people of Hollywood, like, were ready to put on a show again and to kind of handle themselves gracefully, to be entertaining, which I think they, like, weren't through the pandemic for obvious reasons. It was just a strange time to celebrate. And this was a year to celebrate. And there were so many bits that worked, like all that stupid banter that usually is so flat. The combination between the very moving tributes from the previous actors to the nominees, which I loved, and I loved seeing people like Mary Steenburgen, and it was fun to kind of compare notes on who totally nailed it. Thank you, Nick Cage, and who completely phoned it in. J-Law, what were you doing up there? Did you even watch the movie? Then just the fun, like the John Cena bit was just a great bit of physical comedy when he, reprised the streaker moment. Kate McKinnon, deadpan, pretending to have thought that the Jurassic Park movies were also documentaries was like an inspired bit of goofiness. I'm a sucker for John Mulaney, but John Mulaney somehow making the case that Field of Dreams should win Best Picture this year through a breathless recap. It was just a good show.
Oh, I think you're right. And one thing I think you have to give them credit for is solving a big thing, which is how do we make Barbie, the biggest movie of the year, a constant presence throughout the show? I mean, it was pretty clear that it was not going to have a big winning night. It only won Best Song. But, you know, they did a great job, I think, of coming up with Barbie bits to do, of making I'm Just Ken this big, climactic, fun moment that clearly just played incredibly well, both in the theater and on TV, of keeping Ryan Gosling in the mix. He and Emily Blunt had a really fun Barbenheimer riff as presenters. So you felt that Barbie was being given its due, even if you may have been disappointed that it wasn't given its due in the actual awards tally.
My notes from the ceremony include the phrase, Barbie is the people's princess. I think it sort of won the year, obviously, at the box office. And that was the kind of point of the rift between Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, right? Sort of, you know, pretending that there was this actual beef between the two cast members of the year's two biggest box office competition movies. But both the Billie Eilish performance of her Oscar Oscar-winning song, which I love. I absolutely love that song. I'm so happy that she won an Oscar. She has two Oscars now, Billie Eilish, and she's, what, like 21 years old or something? She has more Oscars than Martin Scorsese, somebody pointed out on social media. But this was the song that deserved to win an Oscar, and I thought that performance was extraordinary, too. So as somebody who, you know, insofar as there are Barbie-oppy teams, I'm Team Barbie, I was happy to see that it at least won a lot of love during the night.
I was really, really impressive. I hate the semicircle of elders, you know, conferring the award. I think that that's
really.
But there was some. I think that there are some really good ones, but the bum ones kind of. I'm okay with it, I guess. But
I like that. If I had to exchange that for clips, I would have taken clips, but I would have taken both.
Oh no, the clips are so boring. It's so much more fun to see those moments that can't happen somewhere else. You could see the clip on Entertainment Tonight. You can hear the clip on our show.
I think the clips are huge, though, in terms of getting people to go see movies that they might not see otherwise. You know,
but I think that's what makes the show boring, when it becomes a fucking ad. It's like the show creating
clips.
That moment of Nick Cage being a charming freak and J-Law being a charmless robot. Like, that was, you can't get that anywhere else. I can watch Lily Gladstone emote. I can click it up on YouTube myself.
Okay, I see your point. I mean, I just kind of wish there'd been a Paul Giamatti cam the whole night so we could have seen every facial reaction he had to everything.
His like single perfect like
tear,
nuclear holocaust tear when Divine One wasn't so beautiful.
It was. It was like it should be on anti-littering ads everywhere. You made Paul Giamatti cry.
Mark, thanks for coming on the show. It's always just a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
Here in the Pantages tonight is the world's most glamorous audience, nearly 3,000 strong, all waiting to see the Oscars handed out, and almost all are either rooting for friends or keeping their fingers crossed for themselves.
Before we go any further, this is typically where we discuss business. Dana, what do we have?
Steve, all I've got is to tell you about our Slate Plus segment this week. We were lucky to get Mark Harris, the wonderful, wonderful film historian, writer, freelance journalist on film, to come in and talk about the Oscars with us. And because we had him, we thought we would keep him on the mic to talk about one of his recent articles in the New York Times, which was about the state of Hollywood and the future of Hollywood, and whether there's any hope for Hollywood, which, despite how warm and fuzzy the Oscars made you feel about it, is actually in a pretty dire financial state right now. So Mark Harris will stick around to talk about that with us in Slate Plus. If you are a Slate Plus member, of course, you'll hear that at the end of the show. And if you're not, you can always become one at slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get extra segments like that one. You get to not hear me read any ads because you have completely ad-free podcasts. And of course, you can listen to all the podcasts and read all the articles on Slate you want when you're a Slate Plus member. Once again, if you want to support us and our show and our magazine, you can sign up at slate.com/culture plus. And Julia, you had something to add this week as well. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. This is going to be the final push of our little kind of every couple year promotion pledge drive. So we are in the rare and wonderful position of being a podcasting OG. We are now entering, I think, our 16th year of podcasting, which means many of you are fond of us, but we're not always the newest thing on everybody's tongue. So we're still delighted to recruit new listeners, and we're hoping that you guys can help us in that effort. Please take a moment. We do not ask you every week to like and subscribe on all the platforms where you listen, because we feel like that just becomes wallpaper. But for the last 2 weeks, and this will be our final ask of this push, we've enlisted you to go smash that like button, put a comment in, give us your rating. If you're listening to the show and you enjoy it, if you engage in whatever way is offered by whatever listening platform you currently listen on, tends to goose the algorithm and help other people discover our show. Or you can try the real world version of this and just tell a friend of yours about the show, or pop it in their podcast app when you're having a drink. Thank you to the listeners who've taken us up on this. We've seen our interaction going up on Spotify and gotten some lovely comments in Apple Podcasts, including a recent one that described our show as a unique place where Jennifer Lopez and Shakespeare and George Eliot and Beyonce all stand as cultural objects worthy of consideration and care. Correct. Love that. All are welcome and all are challenged to broaden their cultural diet from high to low and low to high. Anyway, we so appreciate being listened to and seen by you guys, and we're tapping you one final time in this go to be evangelists for our show and help more people discover what we do. So thanks very much, and give it a whirl.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
All right. Well, the James Clavell novel, giant, I can still picture it. I think it was white paperback with red lettering. It was ubiquitous in my youth, a huge bestseller from the 1970s, was turned into a 1980 miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. It's now, I think, fair to say, widely regarded as an Orientalist misfire. It's been rebooted by FX and Hulu, in part, I think, as a corrective to that miniseries. It's no longer a Eurocentric parable. It's handsomely made, beautifully paced, the story of five fiefs poised in a very uneasy peace, but constantly scheming against one another, into which comes an Englishman. How he will fit into the power struggle, whether he will go from pawn to some kind of a hero, it's very much in question. It stars Cosmo Jarvis as Blackthorne, the Englishman, as well as Hiroyuki Sanada, huge cast, Anna Sawai. In the clip, we're going to hear the castaway Blackthorne, played by Jarvis, who has just left an audience with a Japanese lord whom he's trying to sway against the Portuguese. John strikes up a conversation with his mysterious translator, his minder, Toda Mariko, played by Anna Sawai. It's the first candid conversation he's had with a Japanese person. Let's listen.
How long have you spoken Portuguese?
14 years, as long as I've been a Christian.
But you speak very well.
These women can assist you in preparation for your bath.
Thank you, but I've already bathed.
Oh, in the prison?
No, in the village.
But that was some time ago.
What, two baths in a week? What, do you want me to catch the flux? Wait, Mariko. I know you hold these priests in high regard, but I beg you to consider their motives. Your lord is in danger, and I have a ship.
I would advise against speaking out of turn.
Yes.
Owen, you will please address me as Mariko-sama.
Julia, let me start with you. This is being lauded both for the gripping story and the handsome production, but also for being, let's call it, a less unenlightened version of this story. What'd you make of it?
Yeah, I didn't watch the original one, so I can't say how much less unenlightened it is.
This is Shogun, the story of ruling warlords battling for ultimate supremacy. They are challenged by a stranger from across the seas, the one man with the power to change Japan's destiny for all time.
I will say that the number of viewpoints and characters that we are encouraged to identify with here is one of the show's great strengths. And we are being treated here to what feels like an effort to make another Game of Thrones, to use this material to tell a story that is a sprawling tale of cunning and political intrigue and how kind of personal motives square up against that kind of backdrop, using both the history of Japan and then also, of course, the history of colonial Europe. And I was into it. I mean, it is not goofy at all. So I don't know why goofy is the word that's coming into my head. It's very serious. It's very gray. There's beautiful production values. There's a little bit too much CGI for my taste. Like sometimes you can really picture that they've made like a rock pool on a soundstage, and then there's kind of, you know, Japanese maples behind it that look like someone painted them either with pixels or a brush. Why does it strike me as goofy? I don't know, because it sort of feels old-fashioned to sit down and watch a costume political soap with, you know, people getting violently boiled and beheaded. It's gory. It's a little bit sexy. It's soapy. Maybe that's why goofy is the word that's coming to mind. But, you know, it does, I think, a solid job of offering a number of perspectives. And our European sailor character, who I gather was sort of the key important interpreter viewpoint, he really seems like such a hot-headed doofus here. And it is actually one of the less impressive performances that it additionally decenters him as the author of the narrative. And of course, the politics represented in Europe are part of the interesting political brew. Like, part of what the story is about the meeting of these cultures. And that is an interesting story that can be told. So I don't know. I was down for it. What'd you guys think?
I think mainly I would just say that I went in with high expectations because it was so praised, and it also just sort of seems like it's being talked about a lot. I mean, with streamers, it's sort of hard to tell what's actually successful, but this was certainly the topic of conversation for the last few weeks online. First of all, these are going to sound like such silly objections, but they did interfere with my enjoyment of the show, which I'm four episodes into now. First of all, there's actually a debate between two different critics whether this show is followable or not. Slate's own Luke Winky wrote about it with this sort of funny piece that also, I think, finds the show, Julia, a bit goofy, but he likes it. And he says, oh, well, one of the great advantages of Shogun is that it's easy to follow. Unlike so much cable TV that's so murky and ambiguous and requires so much sort of reading recaps in order to follow what's going on, that Shogun is this simple elemental story. Okay, I totally disagree with that. And I felt like, am I like losing my cognitive edge or something that I can't keep, with the exception of maybe three or four characters, I can't keep any of these people separate. It was just like, there are so many warlords in armor and there are so many bearded Portuguese guys in lace collars. And I don't know, I may understand their relationships individually to the other people in the scene, but how do they matter in the larger narrative? I think there are just a lot of poorly distinguished characters. And then I was very pleased to see that Slate's former and now of the New Yorker, Ingu Kang, agrees with me that these characters are poorly differentiated and hard to tell apart. So that's part of it. It's just that there's a lot of ceremonial pageantry about people that I barely would be able to name what they're doing in the narrative. The second has to do with the visuals of the show that kept getting lauded, like, Steve, you called them handsome, and Julia, with the reservation about CGI, you were saying, oh, it's got this nice production value. I think it looks terrible. Does anybody else notice how shallow the focus is in every shot? I basically ruined the experience for my viewing companion by constantly stopping to say, wait a second, why is the food they're eating blurry? Like, everything that's not a speaking person's face in the front of the frame is in soft focus at all times. And I assume that that's sort of to hide CGI in the background or something. But it was such a strange choice to blur out literally everything that it was all I could think about.
Even I, of untrained eye, did notice that.
So there's liberal use of CGI to recreate the Japan of, about 1600, I think. And I forgave that. It's like almost like going to see a play and there's a beautifully painted backdrop. You just suspend your disbelief there. I seem to be the lone panelist who loved this TV show. It's, I think, Ooh. One of the better things I've seen in forever. And I'm in it to win it. I am in it to the closing credits. And here's what I loved about it. Julia, I disagree with you completely. It uses very little of the crutch of sex and violence to make what's essentially an underbaked product sexy or titillating or whatever. It's a show about multiple things. Well, mostly it's a show about feuding and intriguing and a chess match between various players who the shogunate has been gone for, I think it's a while now, 80 years or something, the one uniting supreme leader has died and left behind five feudal tribes or fiefs that are poised in this uneasy peace, but they are intriguing endlessly against one another. I suppose this came out of the original source material. Maybe the novel was considerably better than the very tacky miniseries from 1980, but it seems very precise. and beautifully drawn, and these characters seemed quite distinct to me. And furthermore, there was a dimension that I was totally unaware of. Like, one major dramatic storyline is that the Portuguese are already there. The European, there's a European commercial presence under the guise of these Jesuit missions who have converted a significant portion of the elite, at least, to Christianity. They have no idea that there's such thing as Protestantism. These are Catholics who have converted them. They think there is one system of belief representing the teachings of Jesus Christ. And in the form of an English Protestant who washes up on their shores, there's suddenly this new, like a space alien, there's this, they had no idea a place called England existed, or that Christianity had suffered a mammoth and defining and quite bloody schism. And he is not likely to survive because the Portuguese Catholics would like to not, as colonialists and extractive colonialists, do not want to compete with the English Navy, in Kuwait as it may be, for commercial dominance of Japan. And as to the extent that they're not cynical and true believers, they don't want to have to explain to these people that they've converted that there may be another way of believing in God and God made flesh. So he suddenly finds himself, so everyone wants him to die initially, and then suddenly someone gets the bright idea, one of the warlords gets the idea that actually he's quite a useful pawn because he's going to fracture all kinds of loyalties, and he's suddenly saved. That's a wonderful premise. And the fact that it took a long time to explain is what's interesting about it. You're actually plunged in this world where, I mean, it is like watching a very, very, very good chess match, and occasionally there's violence. And like the most sort of notable sex scene was incredibly weird and sexy. I think it's in episode one. It just was like the whole thing, I find, kind of intricately and beautifully written and conceived. And when I say that it's handsome looking, I don't mean those painted on fakey CGI backdrops. I mean, the interiors look quite authentic. They're very rich and they're very beautiful and they're beautifully conceived. And you feel as though, you know, you're in this world where at a certain moment he knows to save his own life, Blackthorn, by bowing, right? And it's like everything about the constructed ambiance made me as a viewer know, dude, bow, just bow, like just fucking bow. You don't understand a word, but this is a highly ritualistic culture and they will not tolerate your mouthing off. Just fucking get your forehead on the floor. And he does it. And they're just a wonderful moment after wonderful moment like that. All of this was gripping to me. I think this is a tremendously good miniseries.
Wow. Love the rousing defense. I mean, I think I side somewhere between Luke and Ingu, Dana, in that you have to work a little bit to follow who's who. But what I like about that is the breadth of characters we're meeting and the complexity of the world. And the notion of telling a story of cultures meeting at this moment of world exploration, like that is a fascinating tableau. And most of the times that those stories have been told, they have been told through a terrible racist lens. And so trying to attack that material with more of a modern sensibility that does not just tell it from the Western point of view is a totally worthy and interesting project. I just kind of wish that it looked a little better. We've watched it with my sons. My husband grew up in the kind of household where the kids got taken to wildly inappropriate R-rated movies starting at age 9, and I did not. And we're, I think, still deciding what kind of household we are. So anyway, my sons, who for a long time have been big fans of different comics that are set in feudal Japan, are kind of excited about and interested with and familiar with like various bits of samurai culture from those legends and comics that they've read. And so they're like all in on this and very excited to keep watching it. And I'm not sure how I feel about them watching all of the boiling men in pots, but I think it might take hold in our household as like a multi-generational history soap. I don't know. I think I admire it, but I'm not sure I would stick with it, barring this broader interest from my family. But maybe that kind of broader interest is part of what's propelling it into the conversation.
Yeah, I think the extreme shallow focus alone is gonna end my ability to watch this show. It's become like what fisheye is in Yorgos Lanthimos movies. Like, it's all I can see. Why do you have this visual tick? Why? But I do want to commend to you, Steve, because you love the show, and to anybody who likes Shogun or is interested in this subject matter in this period, Martin Scorsese's Silence, which takes place in the same place, Japan colonized by Portugal, probably a couple generations later, like it's the late 17th century instead of the earliest, but very similar visual universe. And I think a much, much more complex and profound exploration of, you know, all kinds of things, including colonialism and culture clashes and faith, and just a great movie that no one saw when it came out because it was very long and very bleak, but it's beautiful. Silence from about 5 years ago, I think.
We all saw it and talked about it. And
did we talk about it on the show?
We did. And I enjoyed Shogun more. Or I don't know. It was so silent. Like, it had very little exposition. It was about faith and not about politics, if I'm remembering. Or it felt more like it was about the mysteries of faith. And I'm more interested in the machinations of politics, I would say.
I don't know. I think Silence may not have been about politics, but it was very, very believably rooted in a historical period with specific, you know, political and social relations. And it didn't have blurred food that everyone ate all the time.
There was blurred one moment where the camera, there was like one of those bits of armor on the kind of plinth or something. And the camera was looking at like the front of the armor and the swords were blurry. It's like, I think now I can't watch it anymore, Dana, because you've just ruined it. Oh, God.
Everyone's like in iPhone portrait mode. You know, that's basically the entire technical spec for the show.
Oh my God, this is what we've been reduced to. It's like, this is like fucking Andy Rooney. It's just so crotchety. I could see the food. All right. I love it. I think it's incredibly good, and I'm backed by the popular will. All right, it's Shogun. It's on Hulu. It's a co-production with FX. Check it out.
The epic tale of power and passion, beauty and tragedy. That is Shogun.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, terms apply. The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Kate Wagner is a sports journalist. Her usual beat is cycling. She's dabbled in writing about NASCAR. She was offered a chance by Road and Track magazine to write about F1, Formula One. This filled her with some trepidation up front, or as she says, some ick. Well, why? Why the ick? F1 is a sport of and by, if not exactly for, the super rich. And this was a junket that was paid for by a sponsor. Nonetheless, she produced the piece, it was posted, and it was promptly disappeared from the internet. The piece, however, behind F1's velvet curtain is available in a Wayback Machine, and so of course now it's going viral. Julia, let me start with you. You're obviously an editor and have a lot of experience. I mean, in one sense, what went right here? I mean, it's kind of an amazing piece of journalism in which she speaks at length about how revolted she was by the kind of money that she saw. She says it will haunt her forever. And in some ways, it's also the parts that no one or very few people are talking about are quite a poetic apprehension of exactly why F1 is in its way a very beautiful sport. But in some ways, this was a debacle. I mean, the piece has been memory-holed. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, so there's the journalistic scandal of it is, you kind of have to explain it, right? Which is that it is customary if you publish a piece to not unpublish it. Like, unpublishing a piece is deeply verboten within the culture of journalism ethics. And if you ever do change a piece that you've published or unpublish a piece that you've published, the custom is to publish a explanatory editor's note that explains why it was that the piece turned out to not have met your publication standards. This happens extremely rarely, and there's even debate within it if you publish a piece that's deeply flawed about whether it is better to take the piece down and publish a note instead about how the piece was deeply flawed, or to leave the piece up so everyone can see all of the terrible mistakes in the piece and blah, 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 blah. To be clear, that is not what happened here. There are no, you know, there's no record of any mistake in the piece or even of any public objection to the piece. You know, some of the early reporting around this when it started to go viral that this piece had been posted and then pulled down without explanation, you know, the editor of Road and Track was initially not commenting, but the two main sponsors, Mercedes and Ineos, the British petroleum company that was sponsoring this team, I think, both claimed on the record that they did not object to the piece and were not even aware that it had posted. One thing that's striking to me here is that I had to explain all that, right? I mean, you guys know that working as journalists. I'm sure many of our listeners know that it's sort of considered a horrifying enormity, a terrible sin within journalism to publish a piece and unpublish it. But now that everybody can publish, you know, everybody can post their Instagram and unpublish, like the verbotenness of unpublishing, it's cultural. It's cultural, and it is something that journalists kind of believe. And as with all of the political norms that we see, that, you know, it used to be that, of course, the presidential candidate showed up for the debates with his primary rivals, even if he was, you know, an incumbent or a past president, as we're seeing this cycle. And it turns out that you can just be like, nah. And then if you don't have shame about it, it's fine. And so that's what's striking to me about this. We can get into sort of why the piece might have been pulled down, what that might mean, what the reaction is to it. But, you know, this is essentially an editor just saying, nah, to establish journalistic norm. And there's no real mechanism for shame. If it takes me this long to explain why this is an embarrassment, like what is the mechanism if people are going to be shameless about flouting these journalistic norms?
This is an interesting question. Like, what do you do if that norm has so eroded that it's not even...
I think one other factor here might be around the stakes. The grand poobahs who kind of observe and police and write about journalistic norms, although they have all been covering this, like there's a dismissiveness around, you know, motorsports journalism. It's not covering Gaza. It's not covering Trump's indictments. Like, I think there's a little bit of a sense of like, what even does go on at those enthusiast magazines? Do they play by the same rules as quote unquote real journalists? And of course they should, and anybody should. But I think that may be part of the dynamic here as well.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny is that you would hire real journalists to do this piece as if, you know, like, I mean, it's hard to know where exactly to expect shame given these editorial processes, because it's not just that you revoked the piece, it's that somehow you hired a journalist who writes continuously about her own class status and the objections of the super rich and whose beat isn't F1 to do something she'd never done before, not only cover F1, but go on a, like, you know, a super plush junket to cover it, only to discover that belatedly that you didn't want that writer to cover. I mean, you should have known that this writer covering that material would produce something like that piece. And to be clear, I think it's a tremendously good piece that balances a sense of how beautiful the sport is and can be with how revolting it is to be backstage at its events. It's like going to the races, you know, the horse races back in like Regency England or something. I mean, it's just so unapologetically aristocratic. And of course, they didn't want that, apparently, that curtain lifted. But Dana, that was what's shocking to me. I mean, it's like, did they not, who, like, where is the break in the link in the chain? Someone picked this journalist. They didn't pick her out of a hat. So, you know, these processes broke down, producing a, you know, really a sort of active journalistic malpractice.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm personally grateful to this scandal because I would never have clicked on a Road and Track magazine article probably and discovered that Kate Wagner, who is one of my favorite writers about architecture, had covered this this F1 race. It was really only because of the post-deletion virality of the article that it came into my eyeballs at all. And I just wanted to pause for a moment to note that Kate Wagner is much more than a sports writer. She is the architecture critic for The Nation, and she also has an upcoming book about architecture called Structural Issues. I think actually this book deal just came out a few weeks ago, and I was so excited that Kate Wagner's writing a book because she just has such a voice. And that, I think, is another part of what's made this piece go viral, is that it's really cutting, really funny. It's sort of a write-around, essentially. I mean, it's not a write-around of the usual sort where a journalist doesn't get enough access and therefore they have to sort of write about the experience of not getting access, right? The Frank Sinatra has a cold syndrome. It's the opposite. She gets so much access, but it's access to this extremely privileged and as she says, icky world that she doesn't want to have to be responsible for covering in the way Road and Track seems to want. And so the article becomes much more about the experience of being a really uncomfortable, usually ethical journalist on this very unethical feeling junket and what that's like. And given that sports publications and car racing are not a thing that I would naturally want to click on and read about, you know, you could have had me at Kate Wagner goes on an uncomfortable junket. And just for that alone, it's really worth reading this piece.
So I have to admit, like, you know, I exist very far downstream from a phenomenon that's become huge, but a friend of mine is very into it. So I've picked up over the years that F1 is just a gigantic sport, right? It's Drive to Survive on Netflix really brought it home to an American audience, especially. And that's an important part of this story, that F1 is attempting to make incursions into the market that typically watches NASCAR, which is such a self-consciously, not just American, but like Southern American, red state, guy, cheap beer, you know, not to traffic in cliches that happen to be true. Like that is the brand image of NASCAR. It is like a Joe Sixpack sport. And so this is terrible for the brand, developing brand image in America, one of their most potentially lucrative markets, to have it revealed as a posh sport. Anyway, what did you make of that aspect of it, and as a piece of journalism, Julia?
It's funny because I read about the conflict before I read the piece, and the piece is great. I mean, we should also mention the other thing that Kate Wagner is famous for is being the author of McMansion Hell, which is a social media forum for her socialist architecture criticism, and has also been a bright spot on the internet.
And which I've endorsed on our show.
Yeah. And she's very smart. And part of what I love is the scene setting she does for the stakes for F1, that it's about to crack the American market. It's not clear to me, actually, that, Steve, that they're going for the NASCAR audience. And the folks I know who are obsessed with F1 for the most part, not NASCAR partisans. But it's a strong, solid feature that despite the kind of clever right around, 10-foot tongs with which she is holding the glitz of the sport and the descriptions of the junket that show how much she is not corrupted by it, I think she pulls that off without seeming to strain too much because of the knowledge and admiration for the beauty of the sport when it is beautiful and the particularities. There's a really gorgeous passage about the balance between kind of the ostensible perfection of the endlessly fine-tuned, very expensive machine and the brilliance of the drivers who, being human, understand that the machines aren't perfect, no matter how perfect they're supposed to be, and kind of harnessing and driving those imperfections cleverly to success are the things that will push them past their rivals. It's just as gorgeous an explanation of what a sport's about in its soul that I've ever read. Again, not enough of an F1 fan to know whether it rings true to a diehard, but it certainly felt interesting, astutely observed, and knowledgeable. I guess I was expecting the piece to be like a bunch of like fish in the barrel descriptions of like rich people being idiots in the stands. And it's very light on that. Like the media criticism has quoted those passages. And, you know, I have admiration for Kate Wagner's work. So I wasn't like expecting it to be bad, but I was maybe delighted by how much more it was than what I thought it might be, having read the criticism. I would also say, thank God for the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine, right? Like,
yeah, crazy.
That is another thing in the world that doesn't need to exist. You know what I mean? Like, we live in a world where things are made digitally. They could be disappeared at any moment. And, you know, enterprising people have set up a function whereby you can find things that people try to disappear. And thank God. But like, who's protecting that? And who's protecting the mm-hmm. idea
right.
that you don't just disappear information once you've put it into the world as a journalist? The editor of Road and Track did eventually go on the record and say, nothing to see here. I just, you know, I was just named the editor. I wasn't aware of this piece. Once I saw it, it didn't fit with my vision for the magazine, not in response to any sponsor. Nothing to see here, guys. Which, like, I mean, it is actually believable to me that this was not in response to a sponsor and was in response to, like, his own cowardice and kind of anticipatory fear of a hypothetical sponsor response. Like, you know, it's up to an editor-in-chief to shape the remit of their magazine. But it's just so embarrassing and dumb to not abide by the normal standards of journalism, whereby once you've published it, you just say, okay, well, if my vision for the magazine is not to assign such pieces in the future, I won't assign such pieces in the future. I mean, it's just such a smart piece. It's not even a, like, it is so tame compared to what you think it might be. It's not tame in that it's toothless, but it's, like, sympathetic to the idea that these petroleum companies and car companies are, you know, they're entities in the world with stories to tell. She's certainly not, like, yay petroleum companies, but she's also not, I don't know, it's fair. It's like a fair-minded piece. It's so absurd. And yet here we are.
Right. I mean, just before we go, you know, it is hard to describe what I felt looking at that car. She writes, the closest phrase I have at my disposal is the technological sublime. I mean, parts of it are really thoughtful, philosophical, interesting, and I'll say it again, very poetic. I mean, that it, funnily enough, had this never been 86th in this weird way, I think people, A, would be talking about it as another triumph from this journalist, but also just, you know, its invocations of the sport were gorgeous. And, you know, it's a wonderful piece of journalism, and thankfully you can still read it. All right, it's called Behind F1's Velvet Curtain by Kate Wagner. It's out there. It's not that hard to find, but we will definitely link to it on our show page.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
I have a very zen endorsement this week. I have a longstanding weakness for pages on the internet that are very simple, just like beautifully designed simple pages that do one silly but pleasing thing. I'm thinking in particular of the Inception button, which has existed online since the Christopher Nolan movie Inception came out, which I think this page is still up. It's just a big red button that you press to hear the Hans Zimmer soundtrack sound from Inception, like the bram giant sound. And I think I endorsed the Inception button when it came out years ago. Anyway, this is a little bit along those lines. It's a silly but very pleasing site called The Wind Map. It's at hint.fm/wind, and it comes from, this is just a piece of graphic visualization from, I guess, a company called Hint FM that is a map of winds in the United States. I'm looking at it right now. So it's this big map of the US. When you look at it from afar, it's not even really differentiated, you know, which state is which. So it's just sort of, imagine a shape of the continental United States that's sort of dark gray. And all over it, you're seeing in real time the wind patterns in every part of the country. And then there's a sort of little bar graph off to the side that shows you what the different colors of wind mean. Or there's really just one. There's a white, you know, a white line that sort of moves through. I can't really describe it. It's just beautiful. It's like
so
an art
beautiful.
Piece. Are you looking at it right now?
No, I endorsed this like 10 years ago. And I love
are
it.
You serious? Okay, so yes. It has existed for a while. In fact, can I read, since you know it well, I'm going to read. This is part of what makes the page special, is that it doesn't feel like a U.S. Weather Service or anything official. And it has this beautifully written disclaimer on it that's very solemn. And it says at the bottom of the map, an invisible ancient source of energy surrounds us, energy that powered the first explorations of the world and that may be a key to the future. This map shows you the delicate tracery of wind flowing over the U.S. And that very much fits the mood of what the page is. It's just all sort of like gray and white, you know, lovely shapes and lines.
It's so gorgeous.
Yeah, go check it out. It doesn't exactly teach you about wind, but it makes you feel the force of wind that's constantly moving in delicate traceries all over our country.
Mm. All right, Julia, what do you have?
All right, coming down the pike with a food recommendation from the old NYT cooking once more. Have you guys tried the kale sauce pasta? This is an incredible recipe. If you find yourself with a bunch of kale and you don't want to bother to take all the time to macerate it or do whatever you might want to do to put it in a salad, you take it, chop it up a bit, blanch it, blend it, and then add olive oil and cheese. And it, in the words of Tejal Rao, who has adapted the recipe from, of course, Joshua McFadden, the world's great bard of fresh vegetables, apart from Alice Waters. And I know I've endorsed his incredible cookbook, Six Seasons, before, but I was not surprised when I learned that this was an adaptation of one of his recipes. But she says, you want the kale, be sure to let the blender run for a while at a powerful setting. You want the kale to completely break down into a smooth, bright, airy green puree. And it is electrically bright. Like, it is three notches brighter, like compared to a pesto color, it's neon. And it's very electric looking and it's really good tasting. And we have tons of kale out here in California. And I'm constantly trying to figure out how to make it into a good pasta. And this is by far the most satisfying way. It's a lighter pesto vibe, but with this really fresh, bright, tart kale taste. And I've also found if I've got other greens lying around, you can like throw in some chard and bok choy. You can kind of be a little bit agnostic in your greens. Anyway, don't sleep on kale sauce pasta. Easy, delicious, and kind of like fun presentationally because it's like a Crayola green. It's like an electric green, like, you know, that beautiful bright green that blanched vegetables can get if you time it right. So we'll put a link on the show page.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, well, somehow some random, you know, sort of tear or wrinkle in the cosmos blessed me with a child who was good at physics. My younger daughter, in the course of high school, discovered that she kind of just loved it. It kind of reminded her of ballet, you know, super disciplined, repetitive. But once you've submitted your mind to it in the same way you submit your body to dance, suddenly it has a kind of music and expressivity to it that's totally unexpected, but kind of exquisite when it happens. I mean, she really fell quite in love with it. So I send her, I'm now in the habit of... I mean, I'm interested the way a sort of duncey layperson is in physics and the history of physics and on, whatever, with no understanding of its specifics. But I send her articles that I read that I find on the internet randomly. And there was one recently I just thought was so good. It's called What Physicists Have Been Missing, An Exciting New Theory Reconciles Gravity and Quantum Physics. I think it's wrong, but I may be too, says the author in the subhead, Sabine Hossenfelder, which is just... exactly the tone of the piece. It's conversational, aimed at a layperson, but I can guarantee you, I'm so confident that a physicist would find nothing objectionable or facile in it. And it's open-minded, and it lays out what this theory reconciling, which physicists have been unable to do, to come up with a comprehensive theory that somehow explains both gravity and the quanta. And it goes into this possible solution to the problem and with enormous amounts of respect and patience for both the reader and the person who came up with it, funnily enough, a man named Oppenheim. And then at the end explains very succinctly and very openly why she thinks the theory, Sabine Hossenfelder, thinks the theory is wrong. It's a really great piece of writing, and we'll link to it on our show page. It's called What Physicists Have Been Missing, just exemplary piece of science journalism for non-scientists and scientists alike. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Dana, thank you so much. It was fun.
It was a good one, Steve.
Yeah. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Bertel. Our producer is Jared Downing. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
I think it's rather silly. I mean, all this fuss about winning one of those Oscars. What are they? Just a bookend with a sneer. And keep your eyes on the losers tonight as they applaud the winners. You'll see great understanding, great sportsmanship, great acting.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.